Welcome to the Life Science and Marketing Podcast, where we discuss marketing and career insights and tips with leading experts from across the globe. Let's join our host, Paul Avery, CEO of Biostrata, as he chats with our next life science marketing guest.
With me today is Hayden Boehm. Hayden is a life science marketer with a deep technical expertise, having completed a PhD in organic chemistry at the University of Nottingham many moons ago. Since moving into the commercial world, he's held marketing roles at Sigma Aldrich, Johnson Matthey, Synthonix, Merck, Thermo Fisher, and many more besides. These days, he plies his trade at Agilent, where he is product marketing excellence lead. Hayden, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this because I know we've been together and we've talked around these sort of topics for a long time. So I'm really quite excited to be on this podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, we're going to take those conversations we used to have over lunch back in the day and go through all the, put the world to, of life science marketing to rights. So now we get to do it in recorded form.
Well, imagine that. Yeah.
We should need a license to do that, really, or maybe we'll start a movement against it. But no, I'm teasing, of course. Why don't we get started with your story? Because I think your story is fascinating. How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, I sort of, as a matter of curiosity, probably low attention span, and sort of also realizing that clever enough to realize when you're not clever enough is usually sort of the way I play it. So I think from PhD, I sort of was around, I found that I was, had a quite good sort of skill for communication. And I looked around me in the lab and there were people that were, you know, could be the molecule. And I'm not that person, but where I have a stronger skill set is around communication. So that sort of led me doing some exploring, sort of even sort of doing auditions for BBC Science and Talent when they were doing those back in the sort of late 90s. But that took me into sort of moving into a communications-based science role, which actually was medical sales. And there are elements around that that I really enjoyed, but there are also other elements where, you know, you sort of, you're more a commercial person, not a scientist anymore. And that actually, I wrestled with that quite a bit. So I moved back into the lab again, and then also felt a little bit not quite settled. So doing that, you know, when I could sort of rally people around, get on projects and, you know, communicate what we were doing really well. But actually, again, it's the science part of it didn't quite tick all the boxes of what I felt I could do or what I was going to be successful at. So then I sort of moved into scientific sales with Sigma Aldrich, and that was sort of the duck to water because it put all the components together. And actually, it turns out I was all right at that. And so I was promoted to a European role, to sort of the US, to a global role for Aldrich. And that sort of moved me from sales into marketing. So as you're sort of going, sort of taking that sort of, you know, customer buying to, as you're going further out, sort of that awareness and education phase. So you sort of become, I know obviously you've seen, what do you want the customer to be thinking when you're in the sales call? That actually became very important. Think, right, well, what do I want to have either priming customers when they're reading and learning about what we do, or, you know, that we're on this, how do we get the understanding to be the sort of same level? So we're having sort of, you know, different types of conversations down it. So I continually kept going further and further up the chain, and that sort of moved to product as well.
What was that like, Hayden, moving from a sales role into marketing?
You sort of go from, because you know what the end game is what's the purpose of marketing and how that links to sort of, you know, bringing the customer on their journey. And, you know, the sales part of it is following the customer on the latter end of their journey. So you sort of think, well, so it was quite helpful knowing that. And so there was lots of sort of, you know, I'm not a classically trained sort of marketer. I don't have a marketing degree, but I've sort of learned it from I'm very always curious. So I've sort of read a lot around marketing and different sort of, you know, theories of it. And so, you know, that's been quite, I mean, I'm generally curious and I like problem solve. So it's the fact that I don't know something, like, right, how do I master this? And start thinking and learning and sort of going, well, you make your mistakes and you sort of think, right, well, what did I learn from it? So you still have that sort of scientist sort of hypothesis, validate the hypothesis or invalidate it and then come. But as you sort of get in a commercial world, the ontology changes. So you then, so it's called process improvement. So what would be your standard? Would be plan, do, study, act, these types of things. So, mm-hmm. but the philosophy was still the same. And it was the same when I was doing med repping. This person don't want to see me, or they don't want to sort of, not require. What would I do differently next time? So it was every call was an experiment. When you look at it that way. So with those building blocks in place, that was actually quite helpful for me, because I found that if you have classically trained, if you like, sometimes I found that I sort of met people that haven't got the curiosity, because they've learned it though. Well, this is what I've learned, and this is the sort of the standard text, and this is how you do it. Well, actually, technology has completely changed how people think, or what marketing is, and how they be, or how people engage with sort of marketing content. And it's also the same with MBAs. You start looking at sort of businesses. So it's like, well, this is the model how we've always done it. But, well, actually, the world has changed. So actually, what is those models? If we keep relying on that, you're applying it to a different problem, your different sort of situation. And I think that's always been where the sort of the science mentality, the problem solving mentality, has been really helpful, because it sort of meant you've not been trained classically into sort of knowing or thinking about it in a certain way. So you never rely on it. So your scientific sort of, element is assume nothing, and validate everything. And so you look at, so it always gives you quite sort of fresh eyes into a sort of a situation and think, right, okay, if this is not working, it's not about doing more of the same and hoping the number goes up. It's sort of right. Marketing, well, if our conversion rate is 2%, that's really good. Well, actually, that would tell you, from a scientist's perspective, that 98% didn't engage with this. So what is it? Why is the night so not so just doing more and using 2% as the benchmark? So if I do more of it, I'll just get 2% of more people. Actually, if you change to 4%, you get more people. So what is it you need to do differently, and how would you test that out? And so that's where I've always sort of found that the intrigue of marketing is around. And as you sort of go further up sort of the strategy chain to sort of product, is it right? Okay. Well, if people aren't buying it, have you got a sales problem or a commercial problem? Well, actually, maybe not. Maybe that when we get to that point, people don't see the value in the product. They don't understand the value of the product. And if we can't, right. So, and have we defined it at the front end is that that's the task. This is the pain around the task, or this is a potential gain you get from optimizing the task. How do you map the product to that, and how do you quantify that value? And that's sort of really where I'm at with that product marketing excellence at the moment, in terms of sort of value proposition design and sort of product innovation and things like that, which then has a really interesting impact, is that actually if you get that right, it means that the messaging around the marketing becomes easier. People sort of looking at this understand the value, it becomes much more implicit. And therefore, what happens down at your sort of sales conversations at the latter part, when customers are engaging with humans, it's like, well, we're on a different conversation. So, right, how do you secure sponsorship from your leadership in order to optimize your business using this product or technology or service? So,
right. Before we hit record, we were talking about how marketing has changed, and I think actually part of what you're saying there is mimics part of the conversation we had before we came on air about how marketing's changed. Can you tell the listeners a bit more about your views on that then, now you're in this product marketing sort of interface role?
Yeah, I've sort of been banging the drum on this for a while now. So it's interesting. I sort of talked to the sort of CMO sort of UK meeting about sort of a year and a half ago, and it was quite an interesting thing that seemed to resonate quite a lot with people. So when I sort of joined, I mean, marketing for a long time has really sort of been the colouring in department to sales, so either making the brochures and all this sort of thing, and, right. And it was always about the sort of the way that the customers would learn about product or service was through a salesperson. So it was sort of human interaction. And that was sort of then typically how companies were technology led, and then they employed a sales force, so they were sales led. So whatever supported sales in that moment, because that's where customer sort of awareness, education and conversion would come. And actually what we've seen over the last probably two decades really is that technology has completely changed that. And in the same way that, when you and I were to buy a car, we could do a lot of research ahead of time thinking about what's the type, what we're trying to look for, all these sorts of specs that are important to us. And when we want, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, we'd walk to the showroom and the human, and we'd be looking to the, and the salesperson would be giving us everything and talking to us. And actually, that's usually quite an uncomfortable situation. And especially if you're in our world as well, where actually we're not, as a generalization, we are not that great with human to human. Actually, because we're sort of, you know, slightly more introverted in nature. And that's not, and that's about where you get your energy from. It's from smaller groups and your different type of sort of profile, if you like, in terms of sort of, you know, where you are. And obviously then you've got a salesperson who by nature is much more ebullient. And actually it's quite typically away from where a scientist sort of personality trait is if you go through all those profiling. And that's usually where the biggest friction of communication and understanding comes. And so, so actually what we're sort of seeing is that, you know, people like to learn on their own at their own pace. And that becomes really important because actually when do they want to engage with a human? Actually now it's on when that's at their point. So it's either to sort of learn something that they couldn't learn from, so for example, to drive a car, we would like to go and experience what does the car feel like. And then you're looking at negotiating the price. And you're sort of seeing that happen quite a lot over the last sort of 20 years with all of the sort of like, if you like, life science reagents, products and things like that. People wouldn't can know that. And then it's very difficult for a salesperson to hold 40,000 products and what they do in their heads. It's just impossible. And so what's happened is that technology has meant there's been a sort of value chasm created about that sort of salesperson to, you know, scientific buyer interaction. And so, you know, so now it's looking at what should the role of a salesperson become? It's different for different technologies and so on. So it's not, but generally you sort of see, right, actually I can learn a lot about the awareness of, do I have a problem or you're changing the perception about actually, here is a problem that perhaps we're sort of looking at. And now is there something in the technology that could eliminate or solve the pains that are associated to doing these tasks? And then, you know, if you have sort of people that come on and start looking, that's where your now marketing content becomes very important about the education part. And then also where marketing technology becomes important, because not everybody who engages with content piece one is ready to come on the journey of change within their sort of way of working or in their organization. And so it can often take, you know, so there's very few sort of people that come at that point that are ready. And really that's where your technology becomes. If they can engage with content piece two, then you're thinking, okay, well, now we think there's a bit more intent behind this. So if you were able to nurture and put another piece in front of them and they engage with that, now suddenly with, you know, and you'll see that the people who are really interested engage with all three pieces. The people who are not interested don't respond. And that may be that they're not ready. And that's fine because they're on a technology allows you to put them on a nurturing track where you can activate it in a period of time. And we've done this at Merck with Connected Lab, where we sort of created this and leveraged tools like HubSpot, which are really good. We were able to integrate it into Salesforce.com and those types of things. And so, you know, and sort of prime example of who do this really well are sort of online scammers. And, you know, you'll get the emails saying, oh, I've got $96,000. You know, I'm looking to rest in somebody's account. You know, those emails are full of spelling mistakes and grammatical errors that, you know, basically eliminate, weed out you and I from this, because they don't want us in the process taking up their time in terms of that. They want the gullible and the greedy. And this is a ruthlessly efficient way of getting everybody who's they're not going to get money out of the system. So obviously the principle of that is that, right, who do you want if you're employing a sort of sales force, what do you want them doing with that time? And now marketing allows us to say, well, if people like to learn on their own, it's about putting the right content that's really valuable, it's a lot rich in terms of education. You know, looking at sort of that value proposition from a sort of qualitative perspective, but now much more from a quantitative. So what's the commercial impact that this product service could help your organization achieve? And that becomes really strong. And that's a differentiator in terms of sort of, you know, the click rate or clickability and things like this. So when people are reading that and they've engaged with several pieces around those types of things, now you can say, well, actually, is that the time to deploy? Would you like to meet somebody from our sales team? And so, you know, the way that the sales role can evolve is not hunting and chasing people who are not engaged and sort of cold calling piece, people don't like. Actually, it's about speaking to people who are engaged, and the sort of the goal really is, okay, right, okay, your leadership have got to invest in you purchasing this service. Or so finding out who else needs to be on board with this, and what's the business case we need to make for change that enables you to get sponsorship, because also people you're asking for money from the organization will probably have to deal with several new digital programs, and they can't, you know, sort of feature of this, they don't do what you do daily. So actually, how do you put it on a sort of compare different projects in terms of value to the business in terms of short term, you know, medium term, long term? And so that sort of return on investment, your value proposition becomes really important, because that's a much stronger thing for them to sort of look at it and say, that makes sense for us to invest in today. And I think that's sort of where we're still seeing quite a lot of things changing. And I think as an industry, we've still got a lot of weight, but we're now moving to that. You see a lot of changes in terms of who used to look to, used to be the economic buyer. That's changing in organizations, especially around sort of informatics and technology and things like this. But yeah, so I think marketing plays a huge role now. It's much more strategic to the buying journey of a customer. And therefore, and that's where sort of the big opportunity, I think, is in marketing.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there, Hayden. Yeah. So to play that back, the technology's changed how people buy. And in our industry, there's potentially a balance towards introversion and not. And I also just think an aversion in general to being sold to, right? Smart people, data-driven people who want to make their own decisions, right?
Yeah.
And what you're describing is a mechanism by which organizations that were sales-led are probably now more marketing-led. And sales's job is to negotiate with the customer. It's almost like the induced fit hypothesis of like enzyme binding, right? Like marketing's bringing everything close together.
Yeah.
And then the salesperson's job is to like wrap that enzyme around the substrate, that last induced fit moment where we really need sales to figure out the nuts and bolts with the customer, but not to do, as you said, the hunting, the prospecting.
Yeah, I sort of liken this. I think you sort of seen Gareth Southgate sort of rebrand sort of the term substitute, and he sort of copied that from Eddie Jones when he was in his time with the England squad for rugby. Is that is a finisher? Yeah, you're not a substitute. That's, and it has the wrong quality. Actually, you're finishing the job of the journey. And I think that's it. It's really that, well, actually, you want people who've got good sales negotiation skills, not acting as marketers. They need to sort of have people coming who are ready to and say, right, what are we going to do now? And that's a very different conversation. So what do we need to do now? Who do we need to go convince to enable you to do this process better? And so the whole language changes when we get to that point.
I love that.
Yeah,
that concept of a finisher. That's such a good way of putting it.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of what I sort of look at that. And so I sort of think that changes it. It's like, well, the heavy lifting of taking people, and it's sort of, you know, it's sort of when you look at the other data points to sort of validate this, you know, the concept of, you know, you've got a lot of different sales methodologies and things like spin selling is a classic one where, yeah, the idea was that, you know, and again, this is not 20, 25 years old, but you still see it popping around, is that you would create tension in the sales call. And you, of course, you're challenging sort of the customer, you know, people's beliefs about how they currently work in their day to day. And it was always that in the selling book, how we like all music, so you create great music when you sort of put things under tension. But if you put too much tension, the string breaks. And I think that's what with spin selling, it happened more often than not, is that the idea was that to relieve the tension, people would say, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea to solve my problems, I'll buy it. But they were creating too much tension more often than not. And actually what happened is people shut down because, like you said, they don't want to be sold to. They want to validate their own hypothesis around, is this the right thing for what I do and us as a company and a business? And so being pressured into making a decision in a very short space of time about that sort of validation, you know, box tick, which is as a scientist, that's got to be there. And it's not burning, it's like the spider senses are going off. Meant that people just said no. And then they didn't answer any more calls. And so this is saying, well, actually, that's where marketing now plays a part, is that you can sort of take, you know, put the information out there. And when people are sort of saying, actually, that's, I'm curious now, because that the way, and this is very good about how you sort of present your marketing, provide sort of credibility. And I think the sort of the challenger choreography sort of puts this out really nicely. It's sort of like where you put credibility and people recognize themselves in what you're describing. Do you do this? Is this a problem at these points? Do you experience these friction points, these pain points in doing these tasks? And then people sort of think, oh, that's us. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's what we do. Right. Okay. Well, would you, you know, what's the cost of doing it this way? And is there potential ways of doing it better? And then obviously this is when your case study, comes in. And I think you've done this brilliantly. I've seen sort of you present, at American Chemical Society marketing, seminars where you've had customers present. This is what our problem was. And this is what we're trying, this is how we fixed it. And, you know, and obviously sort of all the audience look like the your person who's presenting the case study. You know, right? And obviously you and I are in that sort of marketing sound. We're always got, we look and sound very different. And so they identify less with us than they do with the person. And so that's important. So, well, actually this is how this person solved their problem. And this is the size of what they managed to achieve with it, the value they created for themselves, for their organizations. And that sort of then changes, right? You know, the person reading it, well, we want some of that. That's what we want to achieve. That's our problem. That we do that. And then, you know, the challenge is that, right, okay, well, that becomes really intriguing as to sort of, right, how, because I think we're sort of really a long, long way from sort of being at that point, in terms of companies' understanding of what marketing does and what it's for and what it should do. And maybe there's a bit of a legacy of sort of, you know, 20 years that have gone before to this point. And obviously this challenges internally the thinking about, well, what is marketing and what, and sales has always been sort of, you know, the dominant element of the organization. And that's quite, and I think kind of data point is probably not that, but it makes people a little bit uncomfortable is with COVID. COVID was a complete circuit break, for the traditional model of selling, or if you like, or you know, selling to a customer. And customers didn't go on site, and sales people didn't go on site. Then customers went back on site and sales happened. But sales people weren't going in. And so that created a glitch in the matrix and say, well, actually, does that sort of mean that the customer is all right to find out because probably website's good, but they don't need that. And that sort of, so people, some people have sort of, you've seen companies that's resonated and they said, right, okay, now we need to think about when, because we've completely optimized our business the way that we leverage marketing here. So there's a huge amount of process improvement internally, but we just have to figure out getting it right and the way that we sort of think about what salesperson's job is, et cetera. What do we invest in terms of MarTech? And
yeah. So on that MarTech point then, because there's a couple of things that really stuck out to me that I'd love to get your opinion on. And broadly, they are lead nurturing and the rise of outbound again. Let's talk about lead nurturing first. So I have conversations with some agency friends of mine that basically say lead nurturing doesn't work. And my counterpoint to them, so I really want to hear your perspective on this, is it depends what you think lead nurturing is and what your goal is, right? Because people don't buy life science reagents and instruments in a supermarket where we stick the latest DNA extraction kit next to the checkout in the hope that they'll impulse buy it, right? Like, that's not how it works. They buy when they get a grant, or they buy if they're in industry based on their budget cycle. So to a certain extent, we can't make anyone buy anything, and accelerating stuff is hard. But what we can do is make sure that we're top of mind and seen as a credible supplier when they are ready to buy.
Yeah.
And that for me is what good lead nurturing should entail. So you've done a lot of this. What's your perspective on that? Lead nurturing doesn't work. What does good lead nurturing look like?
Yeah, I think it depends. And it's really sort of where there's a change in how a task can be performed. And I think that's sort of, it's challenging sort of either flawed assumptions about the current status quo. And I think lead nurturing actually works then. When you look at sort of let's take sort of a big catalog reagent company. Now, the value proposition of what changed, actually that could potentially happen 60 years ago, right? It was all a reagent, doesn't change. Yeah, it's still the same thing. And so everybody understands the value it delivers and the value of buying it versus having to make the components of it. So all of that is almost sort of unconscious competence to the scientist and the buyer. So really, the things that you could sort of influence are about, right, okay, it's a bit like Amazon. Is the delivery time short? Is it, you know, is it easy to check out? But all these other things, you know, is it easy to get the thing out, the bottle? Is it easy then? And that was the one thing. Then is it easy now to dispose of the bottles and the sustainability goal? So there's sort of different value. And that's more of a brand thing. So the services element. And so the sort of the branding and the top of mind, that's about sort of making the phone ring, because when there's a need, they come to you versus somebody else has got the same product. So there's an element around that sort of what the marketing is for that. And that's very, very important. But it's not something you should use lead nurturing and as a KPI, because it's difficult for that. When you've got something specific, and this is more as you drill down to a new product or service that advocates a change in the way people would do something. I think lead nurturing is hugely viable, and we've experienced this certainly through our time at Merck, where you are showcasing, right, as we talked about, these are the tasks that you have to perform. These are where the friction points or the potential process waste exists in the way that you operate. This is sort of the style, the cost of you doing these tasks. Now, if you had a tool that could eliminate you having to do some of these tasks, you would equally remove some of the cost. And that's where you can sort of look at, because there's a real strong way of changing the status quo. And that's where lead nurturing comes in, where, you know, people are mildly curious. Okay, that's interesting. But I'm just looking at, or as they go further down, and we were able to see this where you could put, again, it's having the right knowing, understanding who buys this stuff. So all of your ideal customer profile work, fundamentally important. Again, back to Connected Lab. First thing we did, so people buy digital products in a very different way. It's different. And actually, we looked at the different people on a consortia purchase. Where do they come from? And you don't know it. Again, we had to refine over sort of, you know, marketing experiments, basically saying, right, well, we think this message is going to be the one that resonates. And in the first instance, like, right, well, the users aren't the people. They may have the problem and the friction, but actually they're not the ones that are going to go and more likely come through and actually call us in where we have, they'll make the change and buy the product. And the use, mm-hmm. and you're asking the user to maybe go two or three clicks in their organization. And these people are scientists. They're not sort of going to present a business case. And they're sort of like, you know, and so one's going to talk about features and one's looking to hear sort of commercial insight. It's not going to work, whatever way you look at it. Either end, it's like a dog trying to listen to classical music, you know, so you have to sort of help, you know, and often it's sort of the economic buyers around at that sort of D-suite, V-suites. And they're looking to see, right, don't tell me feature. Tell me how that feature is going to deliver the value. What's it going to stop us doing or optimize what we're doing? Reduce risk, cost, time, improve profitability, productivity, and reputation in terms of like a brand, i.e. we're the ones that brought this brilliant sort of, you know, process improvement tool to you, that type of thing. And it means that you can deliver faster. So actually your brand to your customers or to our customers improves. So they get that lift as well. So the lead nurturing, we were able to see that, and you can either a score based on who's the typical profile that's most likely to be the champion to change. And you can put them in quadrants in terms of the level of sort of extrinsic and intrinsic factors. So, you know,
Hayden, how does that work? Are you hitting them via email with content that's basically continually building up this case for why they need to change? And like at a certain point that just puts the idea in their mind and they action it. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah.
How
does it work? Bits and pieces. I mean, we sort of, the direct sort of, I mean, people sort of got spam fatigue. And so, you know, do you need you get enough emails from work anyway? There's actually things you've got to action. having your, we sort of quite a long way away from that, and only had emails when people subscribed to a certain thing. And what we sort of like, if you, but you've got to keep it focused. It's a bit like sort of some people liking things and signing up to Facebook or whatever your content that's coming to the media, unless it's on point with what they signed up for, they unsubscribe pretty quickly, or they just check out, or they stop receiving the emails. So we sort of looked at where the people go to learn. And there's a lovely book, I've probably got it behind me, called Marketing Rebellion. And I'm quite sure you probably read this one as well. And it makes a really uncomfortable truth that 66% of the marketing is done by your customers, not by your organization. That's quite unpopular to say in a marketing trick. However, it doesn't mean you're wrong. And so one of the first things we sort of looked at is where do people go to learn? And obviously it's like forums, it's meetings, it's conferences, and, you know, they're going to learn from their peers and their colleagues. And we conducted a survey, and I think it's in the public domain where we sort of, well, where do we, and weirdly enough, yeah, that people sort of went, 66% was from their peers and colleagues, and 30% was from the vendor. Right. So, you know, so it sort of validates the sort of the theory. And that becomes important. So, right. So where do people go to learn? So now you're looking at sort of trade journals where, you know, and the goal of trade journals is to provide their audience with new ways of thinking about the industry. And so I've always done a lot of work working with, you know, like yourselves and sort of people like, the American Chemical Society, Chemical Engineering Union, Royal Society of Chemistry, and all of the trade sort of press around this, because that's where people subscribe. It's important that they have things that educate their readers, because it's got to be of interest to the readership. So there's a demand there. But if you've got something that puts a new spin or a new light on a current challenge or a current status quo, that's actually really interesting. So we've often used, and the lovely thing about this is that it's sort of earned media, if you like, not necessarily so. So when we sort of write blogs and that, like, who do we want to read this? We sort of often package them into things that we would share with sort of things like Newswire and things like this. So to say, right, do people want to pick up on this story? And those have been sort of ways that you get to people. So it's that's where the awareness is. So it's people who have subscribed to have that information taken to them through the channel of the media journal. So that's what they bought into.
I love that, Hayden, because I think a lot of people, at times myself included, think that lead nurturing is email marketing, but email marketing is a small subset of lead nurturing. And I think for listeners, how can you increase your touch points with prospects by looking at where they go to learn? I think that's such a great question. And I also am glad that you mentioned the trade media, because I think in the life sciences, the trade media still is such an important conduit to reaching our audiences. And as you alluded to, when we put stories in those media houses, it has a certain level of external credibility that we don't get through our own materials, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love both those points, Hayden. Awesome.
Because I think that's sort of touched your point. Like, do people want to be sort of sold to? Well, not in the, you know, in a good bit. It's a bit like going, I think that Seth Godin put it, it's a bit like, you know, how would you get married? You don't walk into a bar and ask everybody to marry you, because it's too much too quick. And again, spin selling. So you can see all these things go to link together. And you say, well, your goal is to get, ask someone to come sit and talk to you. And then the next goal is to get the first date. And the goal of the first date is to get the second date. So it's sort of looking at it, right? What is email the right thing as being your sort of, you know, first touch point to, a reader or a customer that you're looking to? It's like, well, actually, again, so if you're going to go on a date or try and get go on a date or get your ultimate goal is to get married, you don't, you go to a location where people who are also looking to go on a date would likely be. So, you know, then so it's that, right. So effectively, what is the life science bar that we need to go to or cocktail bar that we're going to go and go meet people that may think the same way that we do?
And sometimes it's an actual bar.
Yeah, exactly. So
the conference networking.
So it's sort of like that. So where do people go? Where the expectations they're going to learn something new. And so So go and if you say to sort of people, either on your company vendor websites or, media websites, what's missing from this website? The last thing they would say is more advertising. So, and I think that's sort of when was it Second Life? And remember that from like 15 years ago. What was the, Second Life's ultimately started trying to monetize that by selling advertising. And all these people went there because they didn't want advertising. And so what happened? Everybody wallpapered it with brands and things like this. And it's the same sort of principle when you sort of, all the sort of music subscription channels, you could pay a premium to stop the advertising happen on it. And then there's another premium that you could charge to sort of the vendors to say, well, actually we pay that again. And it's like, well, yeah, that's when you as the listener is the product. So here with like, well, okay, the value of this media, and if we're sort of targeting the right one, we understand our personas, we know who's like to read this sort of thing, is to say, well, we need to tell you a story about how somebody had a problem. And then they sort of, looked and they, how they went about fixing it. Every time the sort of the reader is looking for somebody that looks like them in the story. So they want to be, so the absolutely sort of customer. And again, this is very much when I think, when you presented and you had, a customer sort of used, said, this is what we did. And I think it was around the MarTech element about this, how we took the heavy lifting out of the market. So everybody grabs like that. And I think with Merck, and again, this is probably sort of, 13 years ago when we were with Sigma and developing the website, we had sort of banners around a new product that we got. And it was quite a big thing that made it in the journal. So it was quite exclusive. When we put a picture of, sort of a model that you had, the screens or the pictures of sort of models looking in blue flasks and things with nose glasses on, around, hey, this is the new product. Didn't really get a lot of traction. Put the molecule up there, got more traction. When you put a picture of the individual human that, best will and didn't look like a model, because that's not their profession, that got more clicks than anything else, by sort of a multitude as well. And it was a very sort of visual representation of that people need to see themselves in this. To say, right, okay. And I think it's sort of like, I think Brian Massey talks about this with the barriers in your brain. And there's two, there's like Rennick's barrier, I can't remember the other one. One, it needs to sort of be in the right credibility frame to get past the first barrier. And second barrier, it changes the thinking. It tells you something different. And actually suddenly it sparks up. But when things don't look in the right context, actually, we saw this with other sort of experiments we did with the Aldrich marketing, is that we didn't show, at certain points, saying, well, we've got these, we didn't showcase the molecules, we just put other pictures up or did something, or somebody that didn't look like a scientist, those scientists having a coffee. The scientists having a coffee didn't look credible enough. And so it got caught on the first barrier. But when we put the molecules up there, the heat map was all over it and the click-through rate was much higher. So it sort of shows you that sort of A-B testing is that actually, how does the audience want to receive the message at this point? And that's where the storytelling in the areas they go to learn, and you're telling it from a, there's a credible element. It's not advertising. It's saying, actually, let's challenge an idea about how we do things. Wouldn't it be great if we could do something different? And sometimes it's like, right, we could just introduce the concept. These are really sort of interesting things that sort of help you then sort of lead nurture, because people are interested in that. They'll then, then they say, oh, do you want to read more? Or they'll go to your
website. The next step.
And then when they can either click, and once they're on your website, then you can, send them another piece of content. And if they're not ready, they don't engage with it. And that's fine. You know where they are on the quadrants of right person, not engaged, nurture track.
Right.
Whereas if you've got somebody right person, really engaged, actually keep engaged for another one, and then are they ready for a conversation with sales. But then equally, you can have people who are really curious but are not the right audience at all, because they wouldn't be able to buy it. They're just curious. So actually, they need to sort of have something that supports them in terms of their curiosity as well. So that becomes important as to sort of how you leverage the MarTech to really think about the rules that you're going to work on to sort of optimize the way that you're going to then between marketing to sale.
And which content you send to which people and all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Right, we've got about 5 to 10 minutes left, Hayden. So we're going to do some quick fire rounds.
Right. Okay.
There's three questions
right,
that I want
okay.
to ask you. The first one is, you and I used to have conversations in 2012, 2013 about inbound marketing in the life sciences, why life sciences was perfect for it. You described some inbound marketing methodologies and thought processes earlier and the role of marketing and the role of sales. But one of the things I've noticed, and I think economic climate is somewhat dictating this, some of it's the ability to automate things, is the rise of outbound over the last year or two seems significant to me, even in an industry where I do think inbound works better. So I would love to get your perspective on, do you think outbound prospecting is making a comeback in the life sciences, and how do you think that's going to play out?
Yeah, I think this is interesting. I think sort of outbound may even be a knee jerk from sort of post COVID, where people couldn't see anybody and you couldn't sort of do these sort of things. And again, people returning back to sort of physical conferences versus virtual. And I'm not quite sure whether the execution of inbound was really, people really did it that well, if you like. And so, you know, what is inbound marketing? And so, because it challenged, you know, the way we thought, well, marketing is just about, and then you still see it is that, you know, and I think that sort of thing, as marketing sort of was trying to sort of bring people onto your company, moving from that sort of sales driven into sort of marketing 1.0, where, you know, the great thing about sort of, you know, emailing everybody, basically SPACs, low cost, you know, and you think, well, and it was always justified about, oh, well, if we get one person coming over, it justifies the cost of execution. But it never considers the countermeasure of, well, actually, the more spam you're bringing, so this is a really poor brand experience from a user's point of view. That is never really quantified, qualified in the thinking around this. And so also, in terms of inbound, you have to think quite a lot harder about what you're going to do with it.
Agreed.
Whereas if you've got a lot of people that are maybe a mindset that's perhaps sort of regimented in what they learned at a marketing school, whatever, where you've got to show the product, you know, it's all the P's, you go, I does this. But if we're still not moving away from feature in terms of the way that we present the product, then it's sort of a reader's perspective, nice to have, but I'm all right, actually. I think I'm all right. It takes a lot of effort to sort of like understand. And that may also be down to, at a product level, do we really understand what we should have been making? And I think that, and that's sort of where I spend a lot of time at the moment. So, often when I've worked with customers, doing projects for my consultancy and stuff. One of the questions I say, right, quantify the value. And it's also a great final question if you're interviewing at all. And often you can get quite an interesting response. I know immediately whether we're going to a final conversation or not. It's like, quantify the value of your product to me. This should be a really simple question, a really simple answer to give. And what I find is that we don't know. And actually now I think what the expectation, as the economic buyer has moved, not being able to explain the value of this and just coming up with a load of features to try and secure the purchase or secure the sponsorship, that no longer works anymore, because you're much more frugal with the money. So the work has to be done right at the front end in terms of when we're making it, it stops you doing this, and this, and this has been the cost it would have been to you. So this, And when you look at marketing, and I think Challenger explained this in a really lovely way, most of the marketing is all about gain and very aspirational. And it's like, oh, yeah, well, it will help make, you know, if you look at anything in the life side, certainly around informatics, it'll make you make better molecules. Right. Well, the cycle time for knowing whether you've got a better molecule is 18 years away. So suddenly, Big Pharma does not have a problem investing big chunks of money on a long-term bet. But at some point, they're going to look at this and say, right, what is this really getting us better molecules? How would we know? And so actually there's a lot of operational process waste that many technologies probably undersell themselves in. If you look around what we're going to I mean, I work with a company that implements HubSpot CRM, and they said they always get the contract cancelled up 3 months. I was like, well, yeah, because you're talking about the way you position it is all about the gain, and we can help you get the gain. And maybe you might come, you won't get the gains if you don't buy this. But actually, it's about what does it stop you doing or not? What does it stop you doing that you shouldn't have to do today, where your cycle time is day, week, month, quarter? And suddenly you've got some KPIs that are really tangible. And that's actually very important for, because there's so many other things challenging and challenging for the money and the investment, especially in this economic climate. So if you are the CFO, what's the thing that what would be the best thing for you to invest in for your company? And now that becomes a realistic proposition, to sort of, the way that we need to position the messaging around sort of new services and products. The feature allows you to stop doing what today.
So the irony is, I think that thinking would vastly improve 99% of the outbound prospecting that certainly I get hit with. Yeah. So maybe actually that makes the point that the rise of outbound may be driven by the economic climate, but actually the real issue is that when people do it badly and don't customize it on a per target basis, right? Because the value to me and the value to you of a given solution might be different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when we sort of, with a lot of the ideal customer profiling work that we've done, persona work, you sort of see that, well, productivity is a sort of almost like a pillar that goes right up an organization from sort of the scientist user level right the way up to the C-suite. But it has a different meaning and a different sort of impact at each of those levels. And so sort of your message around productivity could be, it allows you to do, for a scientist, allows me to just stop doing needless administration or cross, transcription of information out of one system into another, and passing data and cleansing data. So that, so the pain is that I'm a scientist. I studied so I can problem solve. And that's what I care about. Whereas as you go further through, is that right? Do you want your scientists to stop wasting their time doing that and actually getting more samples through or more sort of hits through the system? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That has the commercial value.
Yeah. And you click up again. Yeah. Right. Okay. Do you want to sort of basically, how fast do you want to get to having the blockbuster drug? So would it be better? How do you stop having so much process waste around your scientists doing, and actually you're faster to get into? So you see there's productivity through the theme, but it has a different context in terms of what the role is so the person we're speaking to.
Right, right. I want to use that as a segue into the last question,
sure,
which is you talked a bit about wastage in drug screening. And I know that you have been following AI and its role in drug development a lot. We talked a little bit off air about it.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the stories you've been hearing and some of your thoughts about the impact of AI on these processes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I prior to where I am now, I was working with Dotmatics, who's been in the industry a long time, known them a long time, just down the road from you guys. But there's a whole change going around, and AI is, I mean, so much buzz around AI, and it's sort of, ironically, difficult to neither signal to noise. Which is almost 100%. It's always like, and I remember sitting in a sort of conference, a pharma strategy conference, probably about 5 years ago. And someone placed the sort of, AI is going to be the thing. It's like, oh, it's brilliant. And they use that sort of Microsoft Go or whatever, the game Go.
AlphaGo.
AlphaGo, that was the one. And they said, oh, look, it meant that, it was able to do this, and it could do something that the human couldn't do. And it's like, yeah, but, it only just beat the master, and it did something that was different, and it was a whole revolution about it. But, the rules of Go are defined, and what the end game looks like is defined. You work in discovery where actually you don't know, and so that's really an important thing to keep remembering. So whilst we sort of see ChatGPT, which is amazing, and actually sort of really interesting in terms of how you can create content, that sort of thing, but again, it's only as clever as how you train it to be. And the same where you've seen a lot of AI investment in drug discovery companies, There's still no drug making it beyond phase two clinical trial, and there's only a very small sliver that are in that. And you've seen a lot of projects collapse. And it's also where is AI being optimized? And actually, the understanding of the disease is that that's probably quite its infancy around AI, and actually still got a lot of learning in terms of what's the rules that we train the AI on. So there's still a lot of work there. And downstream in terms of the human populace in the sort of whole, you know, clinical trialing, there's probably a lot of unknowns there. So we're still working. Whereas in the bit that we, that sort of life science part of the early stage research, you know, computational chemistry is pretty, AI machine learning, we're going for like 3-4 decades, if not more. Right. So actually, there's a lot of data that we've been able to train the AI and validate a sort of an algorithm, or invalidate it and go again and train it, and it's become iteratively clever. And so AI is in this context is, and as sort of representations of molecules, as, you know, the digital representation, with that sort of, I think it's like 10 to the 68 number of molecules that potentially small molecules, especially potentially exist. We're getting more and more, you know, our you know, digital representation is getting broader. So actually what happens now is that, you know, you can really start sort of, you know, optimal rather than having to make everything and then throw it at the assay. If you're able to sort of model the assay and have a sort of algorithm representation of that and sort of, you know, computational chemistry model, it means now, and it's sort of, it's borne out with people that sort of in screening compound world where, you know, millions and millions of compounds you potentially sort of screen. Actually, that the amount of screening has gone, physical screening has reduced significantly. And the reason being is that on Friday, you could put the algorithm and fire like 10 to the 30 molecules at it over the weekend. And then on Monday, you'll come in and the algorithm will tell you, here are your top 100 potential candidates that you could, and you think, right, okay, well, that I've trained it to a point that there's still a margin of error there. So again, it's based on a theory. So now I'm going to go. And so the concept of what a biotech or a biopharma needs to be. We don't want to invest in the physical assets. I mean, we've been strategically outsourcing for 20 years with CROs, so companies like the likes of Evotech and so on, and Charles River. And this now early stage sort of research, now, you know, CRO used to be clinical research. Well, actually, the C is that early stage part, and that actually outweighs, you see the data out there and the industry reports, outweighs the sort of clinical part. Because the contract research part of going and making the molecules now is sort of a lion's share. And you sort of speak to contract research. We're always working with about 4 or 5 companies, any company that's doing that. So actually, as a biotech, you now don't have to have these physical assets. You don't have to set up a lab, because you can, all the wet chemistry, you can outsource all the way through. It's really the IP. And this is where you see companies like Schrodinger, for example, computational chemistry company for a long selling software for a huge amount of decades. Now they're actually establishing themselves as a pharma company, a life science company. And they are sort of doing, and they can outsource all that. They own the IP around sort of the algorithms. And you see the same sort of thing. We've still not got an AI driven drug.
No.
And again, is that down to the cycle time is so long still? Yep, there's a fair element of that. The fact they're not getting beyond phase one, phase two still means that actually, you know, there's an idea that maybe the way that we sort of optimize the modeling, maybe actually we're pretty close to being at a 90 to 100% successful at that. But maybe it's the bits that we've not had that depth of data around, that we just start to pull the data into the system around population and sort of regionality, sort of different physiology effects, that sort of thing. That may be a sort of area that needs to improve, and that's where the sort of the what will make the breakthrough at this point. Or it may be about, you know, probably where people like benevolent AI working about how do they optimize their modeling of the disease assay. So it's really, I think it's a really interesting time that AI fits in with that. And then you've got the sort of challenge around, you know, pharma. It always used to be the commercialization engine to a biotech getting something into phase one, phase two. Purchase would happen then, commercialization engine would take over, and then it would be the big brands. you sort of see the trend
to clinic.
Yeah, you see the trends in the industry now is that actually less and less new molecules are coming out that are from the big pharma. And I think they're reassessing, when do they invest? So if there's a 90% failure rate, by 10, only one wins or one comes through. Actually, if I waited and I paid 5 times the amount I would have paid for buying it earlier, actually, I've got a better return on investment for, and then they want to see that sort of commercial. And that's really changing sort of the investment structure around, or one of the things that really changing the investment structure, and AI is just help, is just right. Everybody's rethinking what is a biotech? What does drug discovery look like now? And obviously there's lots of,
I love that, and how we see, how you've described how AI is like impacting all the different areas. And it's, and like you said, it's got different maturity, and that drug screening story is fascinating, right? The idea that we don't necessarily have to screen hundreds of thousands of molecules, because actually we can do that in the computer and get to 100 to actually then run the physical assays on. But I think you do a really great job of describing the barriers in the rest of the system that we need to overcome, probably with AI, but maybe with other technologies as well, to get those drugs in the market. Yeah. But hey, look, I want to respect your time. It's nearly an hour that we've been chatting.
Well, imagine that, yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on. If people have been interested in what you've had to say and they want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I think LinkedIn is probably, and based on my name being quite sort of unique, I'm very findable on LinkedIn. So you won't have sort of 7 people with my name on it. It's probably just me. So LinkedIn is the best method.
Fab stuff. Brilliant. Hayden, thanks so much again. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Super. Wonderful. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for listening to the Life Science and Marketing Podcast. For your regular dose of cutting-edge life science marketing insights, don't forget to subscribe. Join us again in 2 weeks for another engaging expert discussion.